Sange chö tang so ki chö nam na Kyang chö bar du na ki kyab su ji Nagi jin so ki pi so nam gi Ro na bin chö sange du par shu I go for refuge until I'm right to the Buddhists, the Dharma, the Assembly of Saints, and the virtuous merits that I collect by the practice of giving and the other perfections, and maintaining the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm right to the Buddhists, the Dharma, the Assembly of Saints, and the virtuous merits that I collect by the practice of giving and the other perfections, and maintaining the state of a Buddha
to benefit all sentient beings.
May all beings be free from the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings never be separated from the bliss which is sorrowless. May all dwell in equanimity, free from aversion and clinging. The ground is covered with flowers and sprinkled with scented water. In the middle is Mount Meru, surrounded by four continents and ornamented by the sun and the moon. By visualizing all this and offering it as a Buddha, may all sentient beings partake of the Buddha's experience. Om Guru Buddha Bodhisattva Sapariwara Ratnamandala Buddhamega Samudra Saparana Samaya. Okay, welcome. We made it to the pure vision. Took a long time, but we made it. So we're on page 201. The instruction on the pure vision in order to produce enthusiasm. So the impure vision was to produce what?
Renunciation.
And the vision of experience was to produce
diligence.
No.
If it's diligence,
bodhicitta.
Aspiration, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Aspiration, wasn't it? Yeah, aspiration. And this one is to produce enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it may be asked, well then, what's the need to diligently enter into the path of the mantrayana and treat each experience individually? Remember, mantrayana is vajrayana. The answer is to gain the result of Buddhahood as stated in the root treatise of the Vajra verses by Virupa. For the ornamental wheel of the Sugata's inexhaustible enlightened body, voice, and mind is the pure vision. So now he's going to explain what that means. Moreover, Sugata, that is the Buddha, means having thoroughly gone through the path of the two accumulations of merit and transcendent wisdom to the result of the four enlightened bodies. The special qualities of the Sugata are the ornamental wheel of the inexhaustible enlightened body, the ornamental wheel of the inexhaustible enlightened voice, and the ornamental wheel of the inexhaustible enlightened mind. So when a being becomes enlightened, they have actually four bodies. We're not going to go into that now because that could be a very long discussion. And what we're going to read now is some but not all of the qualities that a Buddha has when you attain Buddhahood. The list is actually very long. And if you study other texts, you can go into that more detail of all the different powers and characteristics and qualities and physical marks and so on. And again, there isn't time or space to do all of that, but we're going to get kind of a really nice summary or taste anyway of the qualities of the body, speech, and mind of the Buddha. And so that's what's coming now. So would somebody like to start reading that section for us?
I will.
Okay.
The ornamental wheel of the inexhaustible enlightened body.
The enlightened body has two aspects, the inconceivable secret of the enlightened body and manifesting all forms. The inconceivable secret of the enlightened body means that the body of a Buddha is not able to be measured by anyone. For example, as it was said in the Ratnakuta, the Bodhisattva Vigadharan wished to perceive the end of the Buddha's Ushnisha, not on the top of his head. Having gone by stages to the top of Mount Sumeru, the heavenly realm of Trimsa, the world of Brahma, and likewise having gone to the world of Padmavati, where the Tathagata Padma Sri Sararaja resides, which is 1 billion world systems beyond the upper limit of this world, still he was unable to see the end of the Ushnisha.
Okay, so the Ushnisha, you'll see that these tankas, the Buddhas all have a thing on the top of their head, and also Sakyapandita has one in the statue, if you notice. Why does Sakyapandita have one?
He was a Buddha.
He was an emanation of Manjushri. And he actually physically had one. But, as it says here, it's infinite. Nobody's ever seen the top of it. That because the Buddha's... We use the word consciousness. That's not really the correct word. His wisdom really is a better word. Is so infinitely vast that there isn't any... Nobody knows where it ends. Nobody's ever seen the end of it. And so that's what that bump is about. So that's one quality. That's one of the physical marks, by the way, the 112 marks of the body, that's one of them.
Manifesting all forms means that whatever form is required to discipline those to be trained, the Buddha accordingly takes that form, such as any form from that of the excellent emanation of the Nirmakaya. To that of a rabbit, tiger, lion, boat, raft, bridge, and the like. Having taken that form, he works for their benefit.
So the Buddhas have an infinite ability to manifest an infinite number of forms simultaneously. Sakyapandita's clarifying the sage's intent goes into great detail about all of that. But the Buddha's not limited to living beings. Any Buddha can manifest as a physical object like a bridge or a boat or an animal if it's for the benefit of the beings. I remember seeing a video of some kind of primate, I'm not sure exactly what kind it was, and it was at the side of a pond, and some little animal had fallen in, like a little deer or something, I couldn't tell what it was. And this primate, they were two completely different species. This primate went over and went to great lengths to reach and rescue this little animal out of the water. And I thought, I wonder if that's a Buddha, because, you know, to have two animals that are so different like that interact in that kind of way is kind of amazing. But in any case, the Buddha has that ability, any Buddha has that ability, and you never know if an animal is a Buddha or a bridge is a Buddha or something. If it's a situation where there's a chance to do benefit, the Buddhas just spontaneously help. Okay, so that's the body. And now we'll hear about the voice. You want to keep going?
Sure.
Okay.
The ornamental wheel of the inexhaustible enlightened voice. The enlightened voice also has two aspects. The inconceivable secret of the enlightened voice and manifesting all voices. The inconceivable secret of the enlightened voice means that though one hears the Buddha's speech from a short or long distance, such as a mile, 7 miles, and so forth, the volume is not less. For example, Madgalyana went to the world system of Prabhati, where the Tathagata Prabhadet resides along with his retinue, and which is 1 billion world systems beyond the realm of Sukhavati. When he listened to the speech of the Buddha, its volume was no smaller than before. Manifesting all voices means that the Buddha is able to teach the Dharma in the language of each of the realms of beings, living beings, individually, such as from that of the pure language of the gods to that of serpents, spirits, demons, cannibals, and the like. The ornamental wheel of the inexhaustible enlightened mind. The enlightened mind also has two aspects, the inconceivable secret of the enlightened mind and manifesting all minds. The inconceivable secret of the enlightened mind means that no one knows all knowable objects as the Buddha does. For example, though the noble Arhat Madhyamagyana, who was endowed with miraculous powers, did not know where his mother was reborn, the Buddha knew. Since none of the Arhats knew that the householder, Dipal Skies, was endowed with the seed of the liberation, they would not ordain him. However, the Buddha knew that during his seventh previous lifetime, Pal Sykes had been born as a dog. At that time, being chased by a pig, he circumambulated a stupa and thus created a seed of virtue. Because of that, the Buddha ordained him. Manifesting all minds means that the Buddha possesses the transcendental wisdom which completely knows the nature and characteristics of all phenomena. Knowing the nature of all phenomena means knowing knowledge and mastery over the uncontrived ultimate nature of all entities. Knowing the characteristics of all the phenomena means knowledge of the conditional relation of the cause and result of all phenomena, such as the reason for the sharpness of a thorn, the roundness of a pea, the squareness of fa wang stones, the colorfulness of peacocks, and so on, without confusedly mixing them up.
Okay, thank you. The first aspect, all knowable objects, there are certain topics, knowable objects, that only the Buddha knows completely. For example, karma. We have some knowledge about karma. We can talk about the characteristics and the different types and how it works and where you end up with certain karmas, being reborn and so forth. But our knowledge is limited. The Buddha knows everything about that topic. Another topic is mantra. Mantra, we know about mantras and we can talk about them and say certain things about mantras and the characteristics and so on and so forth, but we don't know all of it like the Buddha knows completely about mantras. Nectar is another topic. We have some knowledge about it. The Buddha has complete knowledge. So those are called knowable objects that are only known by the Buddha, and only when you get to that level, to the enlightenment level, do you know completely those topics. As far as dog being chased by a pig, that might sound kind of funny, but actually holy objects have tremendous power. For example, stupas, which generally when a stupa is built, there are relics and scriptures and holy objects put inside the stupa. There are stupas here, actually. Those two kind of tower-looking things, those are stupas. And they are objects of veneration that have great, great power, great karmic result. And so the circumambulation of a holy object, a stupa or a statue that's got mantras in it, for example, that's been blessed, done with the right motivation, of course, creates tremendously positive karma, even if you don't know you're doing it. So, for example, here, these animals, the pig chased the dog around the stupa, that gave good merit and karma to the dog. I guess the pig, too, if he was going in the same direction. And that's kind of a stretch, in a way, to think about, but it's an indication of the power of the objects, the holy objects. And this story is about this person wanted to be ordained, and the rest of the the arhats and the monks, they said, well, he doesn't have any merit. We can't do it. We don't see that he has any merit. But the Buddha could see it because he has this extra ability, and he could see that in the previous lifetimes there had been this circumambulation of a stupa when he was a dog, and that was merit enough to say, yeah, you can be ordained. In Clarifying the Sage's Intent, there's another story about seven worms that were on a piece of wood, and the wood got waterlogged and it sank into a body of water where a statue of Vairochana had been submerged. That's a thing that's done, but statues and holy objects are submerged into bodies of water so that the beings that live in the water can circumambulate and swim around them. And these worms, the waterlogged wood sunk, and when it was underwater, it went around the statue, and as a result of that karma, these seven worms were reborn as seven sisters. They were really poor, though, but they had enough faith that they went and they were grass collectors in India, and then they collected grass and sold the grass, and then with that money they made offerings. And then their next rebirth, the seven sisters they had a very, very high rebirth. And it only took two rebirths, jumping from worms to precious human rebirth at a high level. So you should never underestimate a small gesture if it's done with the right motivation and the right way. These gestures done, and then particularly done towards a holy object that has the ability to bless, and the blessing comes from the Buddha in the beginning, obviously. You should never underestimate that those actions are, oh, that's not so much, or that's just a small thing. You should never think that way. There's this multiplying effect with karma that you can be propulsed, and also in the opposite direction, too. You should never think, oh, that was just a small bad thing I did. It doesn't matter. Nobody saw it. This is what Lama was talking about. You got to be your own witness, right? So that's what these stories refer to. And the Buddha has complete knowledge about all of these, and also this the squareness of the stones. Apparently these are square stones that if you break them, they always break into squares. The Buddha knows why, we don't know why. So that's what that's talking about. And as far as the peacock goes, we've all seen peacock feathers. They're incredibly beautiful, but they're also complicated. If you look at them, there's a lot of, you know, different colors and different shades and so on. We really don't know. We have kind of an idea. Maybe a geneticist could tell us something about the biology of peacock feathers. I don't know. But the Buddha can tell you every single color in there, what the actual karma was that created that individual color. And the Buddha's the only one that can do that. So these are examples just to give you an idea of the powers and the qualities of an enlightened being.
I have a hard time with, like statues and kind of thinking that they're something holy, because for me it's always, I mean, I don't know how else to say that, but it's like something that I'm not repulsed by, but definitely not, I can't, I don't know how to express that. It's just simply something that I've always disliked, statues.
And that's understandable.
And of any form.
That's understandable. It's a stretch. You have to, in this case, though, it isn't just a statue that was made, you know, out of metal or something. These statues are then blessed. Usually they're filled with holy mantras and blessed pills and holy objects that have been blessed by high lamas or high beings. And so it's not the metal of the, or the material of the statue itself that gives the blessing. And mantra is also a stretch for a lot of people. Here in the West, we don't have much of a concept about mantra. There is a kind of, it goes beyond sort of rational, logical thinking. However, having said all that, and I'm not trying to convince you, I'm just saying, once you start working with these things like mantras and things like that, you start to have your own personal experience of it, then you realize this isn't just baloney. This isn't just something that somebody's making up or saying, that there is actually something to it. Mm-hmm. But until then, it's a question of faith. Do you believe it or not? Nobody can convince you. But when you start working with it, and you start to see it, then you don't have to take it on blind faith anymore because you have your own personal experience of it. So that's about all I can say. Does anybody else want to add to this discussion?
I know mantras and prayers and things like that are all designed also to assist with the thought transformation. So that's when you practice them and use them on a regular basis, they actually do have an impact over time in terms of your thoughts. My understanding of it.
Thank you. One other thing that that I've heard Lama say that I think is probably a good idea is it's fine to be skeptical. It's fine to say, I don't really know about that. That's fine. It's actually natural, really, in the beginning. The suggestion or the suggestion would be don't completely slam the door and say, well, that's really baloney and I never want to hear that again and I'm never going to believe that and never, 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 never. You know, like, don't just shove it away, but just say, I'm going to be neutral. I don't believe it, but I'm, you know, maybe someday I might, but I'm not right now. I don't. Just stay in the middle.
Just keep an open mind.
Because if you shut the door completely, you shut the door completely, and then you miss the benefit, or the possible benefit that at least some people are seeing in it. So that's the suggestion that's usually giving, like, well, I don't know if I believe that. Okay, that's fine. Just stay neutral.
Just, if I may, to extend what Michael has just laid out here. Take, for example, there's a beautiful temple in Kandy in Sri Lanka. And it's known as the Temple of the Tooth, because one of Buddha's teeth is actually there and preserved for thousands of years. And every year it is brought out especially for the people. And it is taken around. And you can feel the power come out. And the people feel. It's as if the air is infused with something quite extraordinary. That's the temple of the tooth, just one tooth. So the stupa, or the temple, when Michael says they're containing relics, these relics might be something really quite extraordinary, not just the bones and the ashes of a great lama, but perhaps the bone of Buddha himself. And when you think about the fact that he was a completely enlightened being, so his resonating power lasts thousands of years, even in just one fragment of a body. I think that's really where Michael was trying to take us there. That specialness that can be there.
Yeah, when I lived in Italy, of course, Italy's a Catholic country, at least in name anyway, and down in Napoli, the cathedral there has a, it's kind of hard to describe, but it's a container of glass which has dried blood in it of the patron saint of Napoli, and I'm sorry, I forget which saint it is. I believe it's Saint Stephen, but I don't want to say that because I'm not sure. But whatever the patron saint, every town has a patron saint. Every year on the day of that patron saint, that they celebrate that saint, they take the glass down and it liquefies. Every year on that day and only on that day. And everybody's seen it. I haven't seen it, but I've seen videos of it. And it's been going on for decades. And people come from all over and they file past it and they see it and it's liquid. And then they put it up there, and the next day it's solid again. And it stays solid for 364 days. How do you explain that rationally? So there are things in this world that are kind of hard to explain.
Well, and indigenous cultures also have their holy objects, and a lot of their, what we could maybe term a mantra, it's similar with that kind of power, with those kind of powers.
I mean, I don't doubt that there are powers in the world, but it's hard for me to associate those powers with physical, like, with the relics, or, like, physicality of sorts, because it doesn't compute. I don't know why. I think it's because, from what I understand, and you guys can believe me or not, but, like, in the past, I asked, like, why I'm so afraid of statues, and it's, like, in a past life, my parents told me that they were watching me, and instilled, like, a big fear. I used to be really scared of statues, especially growing up Catholic and going to churches. I hated being in there because it was all these statues of things. I was like, ew. So over time, it's taken me a long time to kind of like be neutral.
Yeah.
It's taken me a while to. So it's still like, I'm still kind of like, ugh.
Yeah.
But.
No, it's good you brought that up. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you want to keep going or you want to pass it to somebody?
I'll pass it off.
Okay. Somebody else want to read now? With regard.
I will.
Okay.
With regard to the ornamental wheel, ornamental means beautified. It is beautiful because the purpose of both self and others spontaneously, effortlessly arises. Wheel means the wheel of transcendental activities. Having achieved full and perfect enlightenment, the Tathagatas turn to the wheel of Dharma, and 100 billion sentient beings gained enlightenment. Also, each one of them taught the Dharma and caused an equal number of sentient beings to gain enlightenment. Further, each one of them taught the Dharma and caused more sentient beings to gain enlightenment, and so forth. In brief, until the world of existence is emptied, the wheel of activities, for the sake of others, will continue without a break.
Okay, so this is a description of what happens when you actually meet a Buddha. Remember before we talked about how Buddhas only come every so often. They're not constantly around. Sometimes when they come, the sentient beings don't have enough merit to receive the teaching, so the Buddhas don't teach. So to have a Buddha appear and actually teach and so on is really, it's quite rare. But when they do come, and there are disciples or students that are meritorious enough to be there, the results are tremendous, like these tremendous number of people get enlightened by being in the presence of the Buddha. Now, we missed it 2,600 years ago, but we have some merit. In fact, we have a lot of merit. Just being here and studying this text, we have a lot of merit. And we also have the teachings, and we have masters that have continued the lineages and the practices, and they can teach us, and we can still get enlightened. So we don't have the physical Buddha here, but we have the texts and the teachings. And so we're okay, but there are also gaps when there are no Buddhas and there are no teachings and so on. One of the reasons that we study Maitreya and his teachings and so forth, and there's been numerous references here in this text to Maitreya, one of the reasons that we study Maitreya is Maitreya is the next coming Buddha, the next one in line. There's 1,000 in this time period. Shakyamuni was number 4, Maitreya will be number 5. But by planting these karmic seeds now, we are creating the cause to be in the retinue when Maitreya comes, and then we'll have the benefit, if you're not enlightened yet, you'll have the benefit of being in that close proximity and having the result that they're talking about here, which is really kind of incredible, really. And that happened a lot. The scriptures, the sutras are full of these stories about the Buddha gave a teaching and 500 people got enlightened and another 500 got arhatship. It happens all through the sutras all the time. He taught for 45 years. So that's kind of the way it works. The closer you can get, the more, you know, the closer you are to the fireplace, the warmer it is. Yeah. Okay?
With regard to the instructions on the pure vision means that at that time of Buddhahood, through realizing that all the phenomena of the world of existence, samsara, and of liberation, nirvana are the display of one's own undefiled transcendental wisdom alone. There is neither an unpleasant world to be discarded here, nor a good state of liberation to be attained elsewhere. Rather, both worldly existence and liberation are seen to be of one taste, i.e., non-dual. Previously, one was a sentient being, but through the power of practicing the path, one has become a Buddha. Hence, the mind stream of a sentient being and that of a Buddha are one. Previously, there was the practitioner on the path. But through that path, dissolving into the result, both the path and the result are of one taste.
Excuse me, what's the translation of Lam Dre?
The path and the result, isn't it?
Path.
Results.
Including the result. Exactly. And that sentence is exactly talking about that. Mm-hmm.
Previously, all conceptualizations were to be discarded. But through the power of habituation to discarding them, all conceptualizations are dissolved into the ultimate truth. So, the conceptualizations to be discarded and their antidotes are of one taste. Moreover, one is endowed with inconceivable qualities, such as the non-duality of rejection and acceptance, the non-duality of abandonment and obtainment, the one taste of worldly existence and the state of liberation, the one state, the appearance of one mind stream, and so on. To contemplate the meaning of this, one should think, having entered into this path of the Vajrayana, and through relying upon the treatment of all experiences of the path in accordance with the teachings, I shall gain such a state of Buddhahood which is endowed with inconceivable qualities, such as the ornamental wheel of a Sugata's inexhaustible enlightened body, voice, and mind, and the like. Thus, I shall become an unceasing wheel of transcendental activities which spontaneously and effortlessly works for the welfare of sentient beings. Therefore, from this moment on, one should meditate with enthusiasm that one will gain such a result.
Okay, thank you. So that last paragraph is your meditation script. When you're doing your listening, your contemplation, and your meditation, you can use that last paragraph as your script if you want. That's the way this book is set up. Okay, so now the author says it's best to meditate four times in one day on the meditation subject described in this text. Three times a day is mediocre, and two sessions a day is inferior. I'm going to give my opinion about that, which is the target of this text, you know, is monastic community. They're there 24/7, and their lifestyle is a little bit different than most of us. I don't think you have to feel necessarily that you're mediocre if you're only doing three times a day sessions, three sessions a day of meditation. My opinion would be, for sure you should do it every day, do the best you can. Give yourself a pat on the back, dedicate the merit, and don't feel like, well, it's all or nothing, I can't do four, I'm not going to do any. That's not the way to do it. I think this has to be taken in the context of how it was written.
And for who it was written.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If one fails to gain experience on one meditation subject, then one should not move on to the next meditation subject. Yeah, you don't want to be jumping around. Oh, I didn't really get anywhere with that one. I'll try that one. And no, I don't like that one. I'll do this one. That's really not the way to do it. In every session, one should take refuge, recite other prayers, perform the main practice of meditating upon the meditation subject at which one has currently arrived, and conclude with the dedication of virtues and maintain a continuity of the meditation subject in the periods between sessions by mindfulness and alertness. So this is the format that we always use with any practice, not just meditation, but anything. You're circumambulating statues or saying mantras or making offerings. You start with refuge, you do your practice, and then you end with dedication. And then in your non-practice time, you don't just forget it. You try to maintain mindfulness of what it is that you're trying to transform in your mind, whether it's compassion or love or whatever. And that's the standard format for any practice, not only meditation practice. All of this assumes that you have the correct motivation. There's a saying, the best practice is the one you actually do.
Well, if, keeping in mind that all sentient beings are our teachers.
Yeah. So you can have lofty, you know, ideas, but if you're not doing it, if you're not taking the medicine off the shelf and ingesting it, you know, it's not going to do too much good. The other thing that I try to remember that I think makes a lot of sense, Dzongtso Kenzi Rinpoche said, find one or two practices that you like to do, and then do them. And you won't be perfect at them in the beginning. It doesn't matter. Just keep doing them, and you'll get better. And as you do them, then you'll start to, you know, see some result and have some kind of, you know, it'll have some effect on you. Don't expect it to be perfect right off the bat, because that's not the way things usually work in life, you know. If you learn piano, you don't sit down the first day in the first lesson and play
Bach,
you know, classical music. You got to learn the scales and stuff, and, you know. So I think that's good advice. Find something that you like to do. And one of the things about Buddhism that's so amazing is there's something for everybody. Do you like to dance? There are dance practices. Do you like to sing? There are singing practices. Do you like to walk? There are walking practices. Do you like to recite? There are reciting practices. You know, you like to meditate. You like, there's just an incredible number of practices that you can do. Pick one or two that you like. You know, whatever your proclivity is, your inclination is. And it shouldn't be something that you force yourself to do, that you have to do it. There should be some joy in it, you know. Like, I really want to do this because I know this is going to transform my mind and help me and all my mothers get out of samsara. So that's some practice advice. Take it or leave it. In this way, the greatly compassionate teacher, through being especially skilled in means, will teach the impure vision and so will cause the beginner's mind to renounce the world. Then, through the vision of the common experience, the desire to gain complete enlightenment for the sake of others will be produced in the practitioner's mind. And through the vision of the extraordinary experience, that's another little one that we sort of added at the last minute a couple of weeks ago, the extraordinary experience, the enthusiasm to enter the path of the Vajrayana will be produced. And through the pure vision, the enthusiasm for the result of Buddhahood will be produced. And without any exclusions, all the levels of instruction to establish a genuine receptacle for obtaining the tantric empowerment that ripens the disciple, the first stage of the path of the profound Vajrayana, are concluded. So that last paragraph, there have not been any exclusions, there's been nothing left out in this text. In the levels of instructions to establish a genuine receptacle for attaining the Vajrayana empowerment to ripen the disciple. So when Lama sat down and said, I want you to teach this text, he said, the reason I want you to teach this text is if people are going to go on to Vajrayana, to the diamond path, it's easy to get confused and, you know, go off the road into the ditch. Having done this, and I have to echo Lama, I think it's incredible that everybody came and went through this incredible text, you now have absolute certainty that you have a strong foundation for going on to the Vajrayana level. You've gotten all the basic concepts and practices that you need in order to have a solid... You remember at the very first of the course we were talking about building tall buildings and,
yes,
and foundations and all that stuff? This is the foundation for your Diamond Path practice. And it's extraordinary because a lot of people don't get this or haven't gotten this. And it can be really challenging, and it can also be a little bit... You got to be careful because it's very powerful stuff. That's why it's esoteric. But having done this, there's no doubt. There's no worry, no problem. So your merit to do this has been amazing. I mean, to even get to have contact with a text like this, you have to have a tremendous amount of merit. My aspiration for all of us would be, don't be like the gods in the god realm that just party and burn up their good karma and don't create any more good merit. And then they fall, you know, keep going, keep the ball rolling, so to speak, and practice, you know, because we've done, in this class, we've done listening, contemplation, we haven't done very much meditation. So that's kind of up to us to go do, that's the, you know, the homework, your life is your homework, so to speak. So that's the end of this text. There is a section at the end. We're not going to read it here. I invite you to read it at home. Just some notes that the author made about, you know, how he wrote it and so forth, who he wrote it for and so forth. So that's the end of the text. Wow. Thank you all.
Thank you
for coming and doing this. Does anybody want to have a comment to make about any of this?
Well, just to echo what Namajapa was saying, I think it's wonderful that you have been guiding us, and I think it's marvelous that we've had the opportunity. Thank you.
I guess in the future, like when we decide maybe to go back into those lectures because they're online and we can do that, and put more like effort into it, like in with regards to the meditation, we can always come and ask questions, right? Like it's not like it's over.
Come to who?
To you, I guess.
Ask Stephen. Stephen knows more than I do.
Or whoever, I guess.
Ask somebody that's qualified to answer it. Yeah, sure, of course, of course.
You can always come here and ask Lamaja.
Yeah.
I thought you would make a comment about one taste, Stephen. That's your favorite phrase.
I don't know that I've got anything more to say.
Oh, okay. That's a good place to be.
I'm grateful that you've done this. It's a beautiful thing to present to the world.
Yeah.
And really, we just are really lucky here.
Lama gave us a little preview about parting from the four attachments. I just want to add a word or two about that. That teaching is in a category called mind training. There's different types of teaching. Yeah, there's sutras, there's tantras, there's, you know, and there's mind training. Mind training is really different than a lot of these teachings because they're very, very, very concise. As he said, there's only four lines to the teaching, and it's the whole path. There's no visualization, there's no mantras, there's no prayers, it's just, how do you live your life in a nutshell? And I like that, because we're all busy, and sometimes we don't have time to do stuff, but if we have those teachings that are really pithy, then we know how to be and what to do and keep on the path. So that's one of the reasons I like it. Another reason that I heard just recently from His Eminence Asanga Vajra Rinpoche is that mind training teachings are especially powerful in moments of crisis. Like right now we have COVID, got wars all over the place and stuff like that. So they're especially useful now, nowadays. They're kind of short and to the point, and we can apply them immediately in our daily life. So that's another reason that I think I personally like mind training teachings. they're suitable for modern Westerners. And this particular teaching, the parting from the four attachments, is almost 1,000 years old. It's a very authentic Sakya teaching that's famous to the point that it's been adopted by other schools, and this teaching is given by the Kagyus and the Gelugpas and the Nyingmas. I know this for a fact because I've heard it. So it's widely accepted, and it's got a true lineage to it. So it's truly ancient wisdom, truly ancient wisdom. And so it's going to be different in that we won't have one single book. In fact, you won't have any books. I have all the books, and I'm putting it in a package. But also we will do the meditation part that we haven't done in this class. So we'll have listening, contemplation, and meditation, short, guided meditation. So actually in the class itself, we'll be able to do the whole package, the integration of it. So that's another characteristic of the upcoming parting from the four attachments after our two-week break.
Does everybody know what the four attachments are?
I'm sorry?
Does everybody here know what the four attachments are already? I'm just curious.
You want to hear what they are? Is that what you're asking?
I do, but I also want to know if everybody else knows.
Does anybody else recite the four attachments?
I know.
You know?
Some of them.
Okay.
But one of them.
Okay.
The attachment to self, or I. Is it?
Yes. That's the third one.
That's the third one. The attachment to this life.
This life. If you're attached to this
life.
You are not a Dharma practitioner. It's just starting.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's the first one. We got the first one and the third one.
Steven?
You can Google it.
Okay, I guess I will.
You see, it's how can I say this?
Part of me's concerned or fearful that one of the attachments is other people.
Other people? No.
Okay, good, because I feel like I'm pretty attached to people.
You can be attached as much as you want, Nicole. Nobody's going to stop you.
Okay.
You might stop yourself at some point.
Once you understand what attachment means.
The closest you get to that is the idea of being attached to your own personal development or progress in the world.
Okay.
That's as close as that gets. Right. And everybody has that soul.
Right.
So you got two of the four.
Mm-hmm. What are they? A secret? Are you going
to
tell
me? Yeah, they're a secret. I'm not going to tell you. You have to come on January 5th. Think I'm going to do that work for nothing? You can Google it if you want to know the other two. And also, we're going to do something else different tonight. I'm going to do a short dedication because I'm going to ask Nicole to help me go in the kitchen and bring out some stuff.
Okay.
So we're not going to use this. I'm just going to say a short dedication here just to save time. By all the merits of these thoughts and words, may I and every being to whom I am linked, when these imperfect forms are cast away, be born miraculously in the realm of bliss, crossing the 10 stages directly after birth. May emanations fill the 10 regions in service for the benefit of all. Bodhicitta is precious. May it arise where it never has arisen, and where it has arisen, may it ever grow and flourish. Sarva Mangalam.